Good day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are coming to you from Gothenburg, Sweden, and you can find us online at redicecreations.com. News updated daily, radio programs, webcasts, video interviews, and film. And don't forget to check out our members area, where we just added our film, Architects of Control, by the way, and you can view it right there on the website in high-resolution flash or download the file to your computer. All information about this is available on our website. And today we have a very, very special program for you. We are going to talk about a very, very important topic with our guest David Eich. We are going to discuss the Lisbon Treaty. And this have consequences for everyone, pretty much, people outside the EU as well, as the European Union is attempting to grab more power from the nations of Europe, who has been, I guess, stupid enough to join the EU in order to grow into another kind of super state, to balance the power on the world scene, to create a non-imperial empire, as Barroso called it, however that will work. But this might actually happen as soon as this October, when Ireland is expected to have another referendum. Ireland, of course, voted no in June this year. Hooray for the Irish. And that's kind of thwarted the attempts to bring in this European constitution. Sweden ratified the treaty in a jiffy, so did the UK. The Queen, of course, gave her royal assent, signed the goatskin. They call it the instruments of ratification. They tie them in blue leather and ribbons, and the documents are now lodged in Rome. I'm not kidding you on this one. Germany, Czech Republic, and Poland, I think, haven't signed the treaty yet, but are expected to do so soon. And so these are this is the issue that we'll talk about here today. But before we bring on our guest, David, I just want to mention as well that David has been going around the world this year doing talks, working harder than ever before to spread the word and highlight the important information. And he's coming to Gothenburg as well in Sweden later this year, in October, I think it is. And you can, of course, find more information about this, his books, his DVDs, and the talks he's doing at his website, davideich.com. So head over there and check it out. Very good to have you back on the program again, David. How are you?
I'm good, Henrik. Yeah, it's a challenge to keep dealing with all the things that I'm being asked to do at the moment, but it's a nice challenge because it shows that compared with 20 years ago, even 5 years ago, really, that minds are opening. And I think we've reached the point very clearly where the tyranny that has been working under the surface subliminally to most people all these decades and beyond has now broken the surface where people can see it. And this is also concentrating people's minds on looking at it rather than being in denial of it. So it's a challenge to meet all the demands, but it's a nice one because it means that things are changing.
Do you feel
they need to?
Oh yeah, so bad. They need to change so bad. Do you feel that it's progress then? In other words, you're positive on the outlook here.
Well, I'm moving along a journey that started for me consciously 20 years ago. It started for me 57 years ago when I look back, and it's taken me through many different levels of this. There's been a guiding force that I became aware of in 1990 and now is extremely tangible and becoming more tangible by the hour in my life. And it first of all started handing me pieces purely by the synchronicity of my life, you know, bumping into people, documents, books, experiences that were showing me things. And it started off with what I call the five-sense level of this. This was interbreeding families that control the banking system and orchestrating centralization of power like the European Union that you've mentioned, that are looking for a world government, a world central bank, a world army, a world currency, a microchip population. And then it took me into deeper levels like the interdimensional connection to this, that these families are actually connected to non-human entities. And it carried on taking me into the areas of the illusory nature of what we call physical reality. And this has now continued. And I'm now going into areas. I'm not going to talk about it yet because I want to put all the pieces together and present it as one unit. But it's taken me into areas now that is making it very plain to me that there is a way out of this. Right. But it's not a way that people might think of. It's not protests in the streets and stuff like that. I mean, good luck to people who do that.
Yeah.
But it's deeper. So I am, because of that gathering understanding, Henrik, I am positive. But over the next, 6-7 years, this is going to be a very, very challenging time, because yes. This conspiracy is moving on fast, and the events that are going to eventually bring it down are not going to happen soon, but I'm sure they will happen within 7 years or so.
Okay, well, that sounds really interesting, and that is, of course, something we can return to at some later point when we have you back on the program, because we are going to focus primarily here on the Lisbon Treaty, and that's more in one way what's really happening right now here on the planet. And as you said, David, this process have gone also very fast, you know, but it's done in a stealthy way, yet people are becoming more and more aware of it. I don't know if you want to lay some groundwork in regards to, before rather we discuss the possibility that a treaty might be ratified in October David.
Well, it's a simple equation, Henrik. If there's a few of you, and in terms of full knowledge and awareness of what they're doing and the goal that they are heading towards, we're talking about a tiny fraction of the global population. So we really are talking, in full awareness, the tiny few seeking to control everyone else, the billions. Now, you can only do that if you centralize decision-making. The more diversity of decision-making there is, the less control any few can have over that. There's just too many points to control, and you couldn't do it. So there has been this incessant centralization of power in every area of our lives that has gone on now, if you look back, for centuries. We were in a situation once where we had tribes, small tribes, bigger tribes, but a tribal situation. And the people in the tribe were making decisions about the lives, welfare, actions of that tribe. We then went to the next stage where large numbers of these tribes were pulled together in different parts of the world into what we call nations. Now we had a few people dictating from the center of that nation, the government, to all the other tribes who at one point before that were deciding their own destiny. We now, particularly in Europe, but this is planned for around the world too. I mean, it's happening in Africa with what they call the African Union. Mm. They want a North American Union becoming an American Union. They want an Asia-Pacific Union and so on. What we're seeing in Europe is the next stage, very well advanced now, and that was the pulling together of the nations under a central point of control. So now we have a handful of bureaucrats, not even elected people, they're irrelevant. They just take their massive expenses and their massive wages and play politics and yeah. have no input whatsoever. I mean, it's just a joke. Keep them happy, give them lots of money, then they won't complain. Okay, go away. Yes, you can have your expense. No way, I don't need a receipt. Just go. We're bureaucrats here. We're making the decisions. Leave us alone. And so these bureaucrats are now dictating to all the former nations of Europe that once decided their own destiny, or at least up to a large extent more than they do now, and to all the former tribes beyond that did it on an even smaller level. So we've now reached the point where, according to media reports and all the rest of it in Britain, something like 75% of laws that are imposed upon the British people that pass through the Westminster Parliament, in theory, actually start out life with the bureaucrats in Brussels. And now this Lisbon Treaty, this European Constitution under another name, because that's all it is,
yep.
Is designed to advance that centralization of power even more, not least with bringing in a figurehead called a president, which horrifically currently they are promoting Tony Blair for that, a war criminal, and a major, major, anything you say, sir, frontman for this network of families. I mean, he did an extraordinarily effective job for them as Prime Minister of Britain for 10 years, joining in with Bush and stuff with the overseas wars and the war on terror and all that stuff. But in his administration, which is carried on under this hapless, hopeless guy called Gordon Brown, he also advanced the Orwellian state in Britain in great leaps and bounds. So in every area, and he was biotech's man in Downing Street as well. So in every area, this man played out the agenda on behalf of those who control him, not least the House of Rothschild. And now they want him to become president of Europe, so he will do the same at that level as well. So this has been a totalitarian tiptoe, as I call it, where you set out at one point, you know where you're going, but for goodness sake, don't tell the people where you're going or there might be a problem. Yeah. Just tell them that want to centralize a bit more power in Europe because it would be easier and more efficient. You know, tell them it's a free trade area, nothing to worry about, the common market, the EEC, no problem. Then just step by step, grab more and more power for the center on the totalitarian tiptoe. Just make it clear that these are not connected, all these different bits. And then before they people realize in large enough numbers, actually they are connected and they're going in a specific direction very coldly and calculatedly planned long in advance, by that time, with a bit of luck, it will be too far for them to do anything about it. And we're virtually at that point, Henrik. The Irish vote slowed it up, but from what I gather now, the opinion polls and stuff like that, not that you can always go with them, but the feel I get from people in Ireland is that there's a very, very, very good chance that they will vote yes this time.
Yeah.
And it's a simple thing with this agenda. It doesn't take no for an answer. You know when it's the agenda unfolding, because if a situation is vehemently unjust, on the face of it, if you don't know what it's meant to achieve, insanely stupid and ridiculous, and yet they still push on with it, it's the agenda. And when you see people saying no to things, and instead of accepting them and saying, okay, the people have said no, you know, this is a free union and democracy and all that stuff, they just say, no, you give us the wrong answer. You've got to have another vote and give us the right answer. And what happened, of course, with the Constitution is that France and the Netherlands defeated it in a referendum so comprehensively and soundly that they knew that the old trick of going back and saying have another referendum would have been a waste of time. So all they did is change it from a constitution to a treaty and say, oh no, it's a treaty now, so no need for any more referendums.
Yeah.
And of course the treaty is 98% of the Constitution, which left Ireland, which has to have a referendum for the kind of changes, constitutional changes that this treaty represents. And so they thought they would have an easy ride and just the Irish would vote yes, but they didn't. But it's obviously they've been working very, very hard in undermining the no campaign since that vote, and it seems as if they've been effective up to this point anyway.
Absolutely. And again, I can read just a quote here from Valerie Giscard d'Estaing, who kind of helped to draw up the EU constitution. And this was a quote he did back in 2007, I think, or something like that. He said, public opinion will be led to adopt without knowing it the proposal that we dare not present to them directly. All the earlier proposals will be in the new text, but will be hidden and disguised in some way. Valerie Giscard is, by the way, Knights of Malta. But there's so many things we can talk about in regards to this now, because I think even a German court have actually recently said that the treaty is unconstitutional, but yet even though this is the case, they're still probably going to sign it. You know, there's so many things that seems to, just as you say, lead up to this fact that the countries cannot ratify this according to their constitution, but yet they're going ahead with it. So they managed to pull it off against the law. How is that possible? What do you think, David?
Because they couldn't care less about the law. The law to them is that which suits their agenda and imposes their agenda. Any law that gets in the way of the agenda, well, they couldn't care less. They just don't recognize it. Because they have this global spider's web. It's like a transnational corporation. The center of it is in Europe for historical reasons, at operational level anyway, places like Rome and London, Paris, etc., Berlin. And it operates like a transnational corporation in that the headquarters then dictates to all its subsidiary companies, if you like, which are subsidiary networks of secret societies that operate in each country. So there will be a network of secret societies and semi-secret groups in America, in Canada, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in South Africa, wherever. And their job, and it's usually the ruling bloodline families of that country, like the Rockefellers in America, that are the big powers within these subsidiary networks. So the Rockefellers obviously work within the wider spider's web as well. But these subsidiary networks, they have the job of controlling their country's politics, banking, business, media, military, etc. And imposing in their sphere of influence, their country, the agenda dictated from the center. And this is why when I travel around the world, I see the same things happening, justified by the same excuses, all over the world. So when you are looking at the constitutional nature or the attack or the constitution invalidity of this Lisbon Treaty, those networks control government agencies, they control law enforcement, they control oversight of government behavior, and that network together just works as one unit to make sure that even though it's unconstitutional, even though it's against the laws of the country, it goes through and those laws are ignored. And this is the way it works. If you control the perpetrator and you control the agencies that's supposed to protect us from the perpetrator, then you control the outcome. And this is why the laws and the constitutional checks and balances are simply not looked at. They're ignored. And unless someone has the power to come along and say to these people, no, 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 this is unconstitutional, this can't happen, then it just goes through. And that's what's happening.
Absolutely. And there's so much in regards to corruption and the money issue as well that you mentioned before. The MEP, the members of parliament, the corruption, they literally, you know, bathe in European tax money. One German newscast a while back brought this up in regards to allowance frauds. I don't know if you ever saw that, David, but just incredible how much money they actually make and basically throw away. I mean, you guys have over there now, I think it's her name is Martha Andreas, and she's actually from Spain, but she recently joined the UKIP, the UK Independent Party, and she was actually the chief accountant in the European Union to kind of audit all the money and so forth. And she actually quit because of the fraud and the waste that she saw within that was taking place with European tax money, David.
Yeah, they don't audit. They don't audit the European Union. They ignore it. The scale of corruption in the European Union in all areas, from bureaucrats to politicians, the whole thing, administrators, is absolutely staggering. And these politicians get tens of thousands of euros a year on agreed expenses that they don't have to even produce receipts for.
That's right.
I mean, the story on my website today was that the latest installment of this exposure. And so, again, the European Union is a law unto itself. And because it's so vast, it does not have any ability to hold itself together in terms of any efficiency of accounting, any efficiency of administration, because it's just so vast. It's just like a monster. And one part of it doesn't know what the other part's doing. The people at the center do, mind. But most of the people involved in the European Union have no idea what's happening in all the different parts of it. And therefore, corruption can abound without detection and without consequence because of the way the monster has become an entity in itself. I mean, the European Union is like a big energetic consciousness field. And it's very, very difficult to administer it and to account for it because it's so vast and it's so unwieldy in the way that it's structured.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have a few other voices over there from UKIP, I think, like Neil Farage, for instance. I think he's the only one pretty much that goes against the grain over there. And one thing, of course, that you brought up is the idea that it's a kind of a bribing situation as well that takes place, because if you're an MEP and you might be against the European Union or whatever, you come over there and they literally, you know, bathe you in money, and it must be a difficult, even psychological thing to keep up to continually criticize the hand, so to speak, that feeds you all this money and all this wealth and so forth. So I don't know if it's just that Neil Farage is the only one who managed to keep this up, or if there's a few more, a Danish guy, forget his name now, but beyond this, there's pretty much no voices at all within the European Union, the MEPs, that actually are criticizing this at this point. So it's totally silent, and we don't get to hear anything about the corruption that took place, David.
Well, that's what I said earlier, Henrik. The European Parliament is just a facade to give the feel that there's some kind of democratic accountability. So to keep that facade quiet, you have to keep it happy and content, and you have to give it a very good reason not to want to rock the boat. So what they do is they throw enormous amounts of money at it, and becoming a MEP is like a license to print money. We have a couple in Britain called Neil Kinnock and his wife, Glenys. Neil Kinnock was a Welsh socialist, it says here, who was the firebrand orator for the people and justice and fairness. And he was against the European Union, and he was against the House of Lords in the British Parliament. And he tried to become prime minister during the Thatcher years when he was leader of the Labour Party, but he couldn't manage it because basically he was a windbag. You know, Neil Kinnock never uses one word when 2,450 will do. And then he discovers the European gravy train, and so does his wife. Hmm. He was appointed, I think it was a transport commissioner in Brussels, and suddenly the till started to ting and ring. And then his wife became a member of the European Parliament, bigger tills ringing faster. And it was worked out by a British newspaper a few weeks ago now, just how much these two people took from the European Union taxpayer. And it was millions and millions. They've got massive pensions as a result of just a few years working there. And of course, to complete the job, Neil Kinnock, who was against the European Union and then found the pig trough and in he went, he was also against the House of Lords because it was undemocratic. Hmm. He's now a member of the House of Lords as well. I mean, you know, these people have expendable morality, expendable values, expendable principles. And it's like, I've talked about it in my last book, Henrik, actually. Everything is about vibration. Mm. Everything's vibrating energy. And if you take, say, three or four violins, and you pluck one or two of them to a certain note, the strings on the violins you haven't touched will start to vibrate in sympathy with the ones that you've plucked. Sympathetic resonance, they call it.
Yes.
Now, when you go into these institutions, you yourself as a person, as a vibrational field, a consciousness, a body computer, whatever you want to talk about, are a vibrational energy field. And your values and your way of looking at life, what you want to achieve, your sense of freedom for all, your sense of fairness and justice and all these things, that is reflected in your vibrational field. And you then enter this vibrational field called politics, or the British Parliament, or the European Union. And what you're actually entering, yes, you see a parliament building, yes, you see the European Parliament building or the, you know, the Commission buildings and or what have you. But what you're actually looking at beyond the so-called physical is a vibrational field that represents what that place represents. And you enter that, and you're like a violin, if you like, entering a massive violin that is vibrating to a certain frequency. And you have to be absolutely at one and in your power and in your determination to keep with your values and what motivates you to go into that, quote, big violin and still hold your vibrational state. What these institutions do, and you see them all the time, Henrik, with politicians that go in saying one thing, and within a few years, they are major proponents of everything they said they went into Parliament to challenge,
right,
like the Kinnocks and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And so what this is how the system vibrates people into line. And I see it all the time as people completely change their personality after and their attitudes and what they say and what they claim to believe in. And they go from challenging the system to being absolute pillars of it because they've been vibrated into line. And the European Union is it's so vast and it's such a powerful vibrational construct as a result of that, that it's vibrating all these people into line. And there's only a few, you rightly say, who are willing to stand up to that and retain the values that took them in there.
Absolutely. And I'm doing some research on this subject as well, because I'm currently doing a film about the European Union. And in a book called The Great European Union Ripoff, two authors, David Craig and Matthew Elliott, has analyzed a few of these things. And they actually say that we, then the taxpayers, pay the MEPs fees for travel, living expenses. They have full free accident insurance, travel insurance, and life insurance. They and their families get money for spectacles, contact lenses, dental treatment. Their families can also get payment for things like hydrotherapy, mud baths, aerosol therapy, acupuncture, and just goes on and on and on. And so, just as you say, David, this is more about kind of bribing them into a situation where they rubber stamp, with
that.
A yes ban, you know, on the laws and so forth. Right, David? Isn't that what's happening?
It's exactly that. They are bribing them into silent acquiescence to control by the bureaucrats. It's simple as that.
Yeah.
And when you give your soul away in the way that we're describing, then you basically you become a robot, a computer system that these people can play and use as they see fit, because you've basically given your soul away by taking the money for keeping quiet, taking the money to turn a blind eye. And this is what most of them do. Once they get in there, the lifestyle becomes more important to them than challenging the system. I mean, you look at some of the rules, Henrik, of how long these MEPs can actually speak in a debate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like a couple of minutes sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the point? And, you know, I've seen, I was the national spokesman for the Green Party in Britain in the 1980s, towards the late 1980s, which was important in my own awakening because it allowed me to see politics from the inside and what a nonsense it was, and how, even though you see parties who claim to be different, like the Green Party, they're actually just the same face with a different mask on.
Yeah.
And people I knew at that time who were then young activists in the Green Party are now members of the European Parliament. And I see them now and again on television. I watch them being interviewed. I see them debating. And all I'm looking at is an off-the-peg, standard issue, off-the-software-shelf politician saying, dressing like all the others. And the Green Party members of the European Parliament from Britain are just clones of all the other politicians that they said the Green Party was there to challenge. It's a new politics. No, it's not. And again, you know, they've been pulled in by the system, vibrated into line. They are articulating this nonsense about human-caused global warming, or they call it now climate change because temperatures have been falling. And they're being played like, again, appropriately, a violin by the system. These were people that said they were had come to change politics. Well, no. Politics has changed them, as it does with everybody virtually.
And then you have another issue here. I just want to read you a quote quickly here, which is kind of interesting in regards to what kind of people also might be attracted to the European Union and becoming an MEP, because they write in the same book I mentioned before that usually being an MEP gives immunity from prosecution unless your college vote to suspend your immunity, which rarely happens. But they said that in several EU countries, rich fraudsters feeling the hot breath of the forces of law and order on their backs of their necks have quickly bought themselves seats as MEPs by making large contributions to local political parties. Thus, as long as they maintain their lucrative but legal Brussels jobs, they could stick two fingers up at the police and at those they had defrauded. In many cases, by the time they eventually left the European Parliament, local statutes and limitations meant that they could no longer be prosecuted for the crimes they perpetrated before hurriedly decamping to the well-paid safety of Brussels. What do you think about that, David?
Well, I mean, that's typical. I mean, what we're looking at is an evolving, fast-evolving global system in which people are being taxed more and more, controlled more and more, have more and more laws imposed on the fine detail of their lives. I mean, you know, the government here is now saying it's going to introduce cameras compulsorily in people's houses who they say are not looking after their children properly, so they can be watched 24/7 to make sure that this happens to the children, that happens to the children. These are Orwell's telescreens. I mean, this is how far we've gone now.
Yeah.
And so that's happening on the side of the mass of the people. That's what we're being subjected to. But the system is also evolving to give more and more money, more and more immunity from the laws that they're passing for themselves to be imposed on other people. And it's creating this upper class, this elite class. People call it the political class. It's more than that because it goes into other areas. But this elite class of people who are making law for the rest of the people but not being subjected to it themselves. And there's more and more of these kind of get-outs that you're talking about here.
Yeah.
I've looking at a story on my website now, which was posted today. It's just a little bit from it. It's just an extraordinary story. It's about the European Parliament and the expenses. It says here, MEPs can claim a subsistence allowance of about £270 a day, tax-free, for every day they turn up to work.
Yep.
This gives them another £43,000 a year, tax-free. Again, no receipts needed. MEPs, wait for this, call this the allowance, the sign-on-sod-off allowance, because all they have to do to get it is to sign in. It's like someone, you know, going to the school, the register's taken, they get 270 quid and go home.
Yeah.
They're £80 a night for hotels, £190 a day they get for allowance for lunch and dinner, or what's left from the allowance that they get for overall things. They are generously subsidized restaurants in the parliament with political parties, and around 15,000 lobbyists hosting endless champagne-fueled dinner events. Most MEPs would struggle to use much of this money, making it relatively easy to pocket at least another 20,000 or more a year tax-free.
God.
Once you add in the thousands more, it says, to be made from travel expenses and the money MEPs receive for themselves and their assistants when they complete their time in the parliament, Most MEPs can live like royalty at our expense and still walk away with around £1 million in their bank accounts off just 1 5-year term. So that is just a little glimpse at the scale of corruption and bribery that's going on. And again, all the bureaucrats want is to be left alone to do what they want, which is to create a fascist, well, I say create, they've already created, just how deeply we go into it, a centralized fascist state in Europe.
That's right. And also I want to mention that once they actually leave office, MEPs can continue to enjoy what they call a transitional allowance. So basically it's their parliamentary salary for another 6 months to 2 years. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. And we had a controversy over here because we have a, if there was a, an award or a cup for the most corrupt, the most pig trough politician that I've come across, it's a man called Peter Mandelson.
Right,
man could be corrupt for the world. I mean, he could represent this planet at corruption. And he is now running Britain. I mean, he was a European commissioner and made an absolute fortune. I think he was a trade commissioner. And then when he was invited back to join Brown's government, then it came out about the transitional payments he was going to get from Brussels even after he left, which were ridiculously high. Hmm. And he was appointed to the House of Lords, which means he doesn't have to be elected. And now he is the most powerful man in the government. And Mandelson is a blatant agent of the Rothschild family. He's very close to them. So, and he's also the man behind Tony Blair. So you see the same characters keep coming up everywhere. And for people who don't know this guy, Peter Mandelson, in other parts of Europe, watch him like a hawk, because this man is a real agent. A real worker on behalf of the agenda on the inside and the outside. And he is very much being connected to the European Union, as someone like him would be in the way things are going. And he's come out recently and said Britain should join the euro because that's the whole agenda. So anything that comes out of Mandelson's mouth in Britain or anywhere else is the agenda, and it's overwhelmingly the European Union agenda because he is so close to that organization.
Just incredible. And don't know if you've heard about the report that details a little bit of this. It's called the Galvin Report. I think his name was Robert Galvin. Have you heard about that, David?
I don't know. Fill me in.
Well, basically it was an internal kind of audit service that found some of this evidence on how much corruption goes on within the EU and how much money the MEPs are getting. And basically this was prevented from leaking at first. And eventually it actually is available now on WikiLeaks. I can put up a link to this on in relation to this interview so people can check it out for themselves, because it's a really, really important report that goes into some of these issues. But one thing I want to mention to you, David, as well in regards to this, is that apparently, so David Craig and Matthew Elliott write in this book that documents that are given to MEPs are actually watermarked, and they're actually changed a little bit in their structure, which means that MEPs are frightened to release the reports, because that means that they can track back to who it was who leaked the documents. So it's a really, really interesting situation that they're doing lockdown within the structure of the EU itself and trying to prevent anything from reaching out to the public, you know?
It's a tyranny. And the more that you centralize power, the more power you have to centralize even quicker. And so this European Union tyranny is moving forward faster and faster. The more it centralizes power, the more power it has to move the centralization on even faster. And, you know, there's dissidents from the former Soviet Union who've come to Britain and quite rightly pointed out that the structure of the European Union is just like the old Soviet Union with the Politburo and all this stuff. It's just a mirror of it. And, you know, people don't realize the scale of what's going on because they don't follow the news and the detail of the changes that go through in this legislation coming out of the European Union, which is very I mean, you talked about Valéry Giscard-d'Estaing earlier and what he said about changing the wording so people don't realize what it means. These bureaucrats, particularly in the European Union, because they have the most devious ones there, although they're in European national parliaments as well, of course, they are experts at wording legislation so that people don't see what it really means. And then when you try to do something, oh, no, you can't do that, or you have to do this, you say, well, when did that? Oh, yeah, here it is. Clause 7, subclause 5, and all the rest of it. That's where the thing that makes politics and so-called democracy so ludicrous, not just in the European Union, but my goodness me, it's this a massive example, but in national parliaments as well, is that the politicians who vote for it never read it. They read a fraction of what goes through. The Patriot Act in America went through. People weren't given a chance to read that. The stuff that went through with regard to the banking bailout towards the end of the last year in the Bush administration, etc. They never read that. There's so much legislation being put before politicians just to rubber stamp, and it's so detailed, and there's so many elements to it. There's no way, A, they're going to read it, and B, they're going to understand most of it anyway.
Yeah.
And so they're voting through into so-called democratic law what is nothing more than laws that have been decided and written by bureaucrats that no one ever knows about.
Yeah.
And of course, what you've seen to make this even more potent in the last few years and even decades, it's got faster and faster, is the speed and the expansion of the amount of legislation that is going through parliaments and the European Union. There's just so much of it, they can't keep up with it. And within all that legislation are all the key clauses and all the key laws that are building this fascist dictatorship. I think it was during the 10 years of Tony Blair in the British Parliament, I think the figure was that a new law was passed on average every 3 hours.
Oh, God.
I mean, just think about that.
Yeah. Sheesh. It's just, it's insane, as you say, and who can keep up with it, really? And it's a fascist bureaucracy. That's what, you know, we're faced with here in one way. And I also, on top of this, of course, we have the potential, you know, political ideology of the EU that we can discuss as well. I don't know if you know that Barroso actually was, at one point, he was, I think, kind of a prominent member for the student Maoist movement in Portugal around like 79 or whatever, when they had their communist period over there. And he is, of course, today the president of the European Commission. And he and Sarkozy, of course, are the poster boys for this, but they basically laugh in Neil Farage's face when he actually exposes the people that he have chosen to represent European Union on the higher levels, and just he detailed the fraud that these people have been involved with, you know. And to me, at least at this point, it seems like the overarching ideology of the European Union now is actually going to be more like a socialist dictatorship, just as you mentioned that this guy, I think his name is Vladimir Bukovsky, who warned that the EU is turning into another Soviet kind of dictatorship here.
Yeah, that's the guy. And what has happened with the European Union is that the interbreeding families in the background have orchestrated all of this. If you go back to the earlier part of the 20th century, you pick up organizations like the Pan-Europa movement, which was very close to the Rothschild family and the Habsburg dynasty.
Yes, that's right.
In fact, Otto von Habsburg is still its official head all these years later. They were orchestrating this whole thing. And of course, after the Second World War, when all those millions of people were killed and maimed to stop the Nazis taking control of the whole of Europe, if what we have now had been proposed, then there would have been an outcry. So what they did was do the totalitarian tiptoe. But this, where we are now, was always going to be where it was heading. And there has been certain key people in Britain. There was a man called Ted Heath.
Yes,
who is massively exposed in my books. I mean, this man was a Satanist, a serial child killer on an amazing level. I mean, this man was unbelievable. He's dead now. But I said all this in my books before he died, and a journalist rang him after a book called The Biggest Secret came out, just a few days, and read the passages to him that where I was talking about him. Now, this was a powerful man who could have had me in court in a minute if he wanted to. Mm-hmm. But all he said was, David Icke must be mad. And that was it. Hmm. And then never heard another word, because I know from so many sources that what I was saying about him was true.
And he didn't want to bring it up, I guess.
Exactly. And he was the front man to bring the European dictatorship to Britain. In fact, he was prime minister between 1970 and 74, and he was the one who signed us into the common market, which became the European Union. So and he was a Bilderberger. He was close to the Rothschilds, usual thing. These families put in the different, I mean, Sarkozy's a wonderful example in France now, and Mandelson in Britain. They put their key agents in the different countries, and their job, as I was saying earlier, their job is to introduce the agenda in their sphere of influence, and that is, over the decades since the 40s and 50s, get your country in the European Union, agree to more and more centralization of power and less power for national parliaments, and it moves on to where we are now. But it's being orchestrated in the background by these families, and they want exactly the same all over the world, to have the second tier of government under the world government, which they're now working to introduce.
And for people who are interested in more of the pan-European movement and who got started on that, could check up on a guy called Richard Nicholas von Kudenhorff-Kalergi as well. I'm going to have a link up on this so people
can. Yeah, that's the guy. Research. Yeah, he worked with the Habsburgs.
That's right, exactly. Another bloodline actually had some samurai nobility from Japan in his past, he was what they call kind of the first European. You know, they have this idea about the pan-Europeanism, that they're trying to create a kind of a European identity as well. As they're eroding the national identity, they kind of need something to replace that. And you can kind of see that emerging right now as well.
What they're doing, Henrik, and when I'm talking about Ted Heath, funnily enough, we have a thing in this country called the 30-year rule, and when cabinet documents and stuff, well, the ones they don't stop coming out even then are made public and stuff. And it came out eventually what Ted Heath was doing, and what Ted, and this applies to every country. This happens in every country. What Ted Heath was agreeing to things on behalf of Britain that he wasn't telling Britain he was agreeing to. And what clearly has been orchestrated through these years in every country, and these Ted Heath documents absolutely confirmed it, is right from the start, the idea, coming to what you've just been talking about, has been to turn the European Union into the equivalent of a country.
Yes.
And with each area of the European Union being designated to specialize in certain things. So when you read these documents and you see that Ted Heath was agreeing that, believe it or not, an island nation, the United Kingdom, was not going to specialize in fishing. What? It was not going to specialize in things like coal mining and production. It was going to be like a services and financial center, right? And that other parts of the Europe were going to specialize in this, and other parts were going to specialize in that. And then you look at what's happened since, as the decades have unfolded, the laws of the European Union have absolutely devastated the British fishing industry.
Yeah.
We have no coal mining industry in Britain anymore. Our industrial base has been run down systematically. And for people that may be new to this, you know, these guys are not making this up as they go along. What is happening in the world now has been planned for not just decades, but hundreds of years, because people say that's not possible. Yes, it is if you go beyond just human beings. It certainly is possible. And it's playing out as it's been long orchestrated. And the European Union is designed to become a single entity on the lines of what we now call a nation state. And the idea, of course, as you well know, Henrik, is to break nation states up into regions.
Yes.
to de-unify any unified response to the edifice of power above it, the European Union. And again, regions, so you're making Europe into a vast, in effect, nation state. And the idea, not just in Europe, but demonstrably here, but also in America as well, is to bring down borders because they don't want nation states, so bring down the borders. But in bringing down the borders, what happens is people from different parts of the European Union with different original cultures move into other parts with different cultures. And what they're doing, and the people who are going in are being just as manipulated as those that are being affected by that, they're breaking down any sense of nationhood on purpose. They're doing the same thing in the United States for the same reasons.
Yeah.
This is not about it not being a great thing that you know, people of different cultures come together and live together and all the rest of it. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Sure.
But if we're going to be streetwise to the agenda, we also need to ask, why are they doing this? What is one level of what's going on here? It's the same in America. You know, I've never had a gun in my life. I wouldn't use a gun. I don't believe in violence. End of story. But you then got to, if you're going to be streetwise, you've got to ask the question, despite that, why? What is the real agenda behind gun laws in America taking guns that are normally quite legally held by people for their own use and all the rest of it? In America, it's part of the culture. Why is there such an effort to take that out?
Exactly.
Oh, it's to protect people. No, it's not. It's because there is a plan to have a military takeover in America, and the fewer guns there are among the population, the easier and more straightforward that's going to be. So when we look at why all these different cultures are moving in and melding with other different cultures, people might say, oh, yes, a multicultural society, that's great. Well, yes, it may be. And fine, great. But ask the question. Why is there another level to this? And it is.
Yeah, it is.
It's to destroy a sense of nationhood, because they're preparing people to become Europeans. We're all Europeans now, and the next stage of that, we're all world citizens.
The global citizen,
And I'm seeing, you know, quite a few articles now over the last year or two in British newspapers asking the question, what is it to be British anymore?
Hmm.
Is it a fried breakfast? Is it fish and chips? What is it? Because and that has been systematically done, just like everything else, to bring about this European state.
That's right. And I totally agree with you, David, because what I see is that actually diversity is destroyed and kind of culture is eroded in one way. And I feel that that's what they consciously are doing. They're ripping the roots out from you know, the different cultures, not only Europe, then, as you say, but what worldwide. But they need to do that in order to kind of bring people into a more global society, a global world, you know, or a global world government where everyone is the world citizen. But of course, I kind of frown a little bit upon that, because what I see as a consequence of that is that the multitude and diversity that you know makes the human species so great in that sense is actually taken away and eroded. Don't know if you agree with that or not, David.
Well, exactly that. I mean, you look, Henrik, at any tyranny, any dictatorship, and what does it want? It wants uniformity.
Yeah.
Diversity is its worst nightmare. So any dictatorship where the few wish to control the many, first of all, as I said earlier, they have to centralize decision-making, but also they have to take away diversity so everything is uniform. Tyrannies work on uniformity. And freedom, places of freedom, work on encouraging and glorying in diversity and choice. So when you look at the European Union, what is its law base constantly doing? It's unifying law across every country in the European Union, so every country is the same.
Yeah.
it's seeking this uniformity, and any country or person, people that want to break out of that uniformity, well, then the challenge comes from the legislators and the law enforcement to stop you breaking out of it. And what we need is a mass, first of all, understanding of what we're facing, and that's coming, but please, a bit quicker.
Yeah.
But also then the next stage, which is a mass refusal to cooperate with the system, because the system can only function with the acquiescence of the mass of the people. Because if enough people said no, then they couldn't enforce it upon us. They can enforce it upon us physically through soldiers at the door and all the rest of it if the numbers are small. But if the numbers are very large, they can't. How can they have a global vaccination program if vast numbers of people say, we're not having the vaccine, and by the way, neither is my children? Mm. You know, there's not enough people to knock on your door with a vaccine.
That's right.
So what we need to do is to start to, in large numbers, stop even waking up to the point of being aware of what's going on. Go beyond that. Because, you know, what I see, Henrik, is a lot of people are now beginning to see it, because it's becoming so blatant, and people who worked for all these years to point out that it was coming and what was behind it, have helped with all that. Mm. But what I see is large numbers of people who have started to see it, who have gone to the next stage, which is to be observers in awareness of their own enslavement. Oh, look, you see what's happening now. Oh, they're doing this because of that. Oh, I knew this was coming. That's a problem reaction, isn't it? Oh, that's right. Yeah, okay. So, but how does that benefit us if you move from being in ignorance of what's going on to becoming a spectator to it?
Yeah.
It still goes on. We need to come together and start to take responsibility. And at the end of every day, ask the question. I know it's difficult because people have to earn a living, all the rest of it, but please, you know, this is so important, and we're looking this in the eye now. The end of every day, even the end of every week, what have I done to make a contribution to communicating what is happening with regard to this tyranny and to doing something about it? Mm. And if the answer is nothing, then don't complain.
That's right. Good point. So if we talk about this idea in the last couple of minutes here, David, if it indeed gets ratified now, do you know if is there anything we can do at this point in regards to saying no to it on a legal level? I haven't researched this myself, and I'm not aware if we can do petitions or whatever it might be in order to actually stop the ratification of the treaty. Do you have any information on that at all?
Well, I mean, that's for people who are experts in European law and have studied it at a deep level, because, as I said earlier, the European legislation is such a unbelievable web of interconnected legislation, laws and clauses, that it's just almost unfathomable as it's meant to be. The best thing that could happen is that the Irish voted no, which would throw a spanner in the works. Because they do have this constitutional law they have to follow because of the changes that are planned to take place in that country as a result of the treaty. And like I say, the last I heard, they were on the way to voting yes. And I have to say, it's kind of ironic that I was supposed to go to Ireland in early September and expose all this, expose the background, the history, the people behind it. And some people from the Irish coalition trying to get people to vote no invited me. And then suddenly I was uninvited and told that I really shouldn't go because I talk about reptilian entities.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I wrote a newsletter this week about the fact that there is a hierarchy of denial, fear, and suppression. Mm. And you know, people who are exposing some levels of this conspiracy think that they are thinking differently to those that know nothing about it and reject the fact that it's a conspiracy. But actually, it's just a hierarchy. You know, there are those that dismiss the conspiracy. Then there are those that say, oh, yes, there is a conspiracy, but or put it another way, that those that dismiss the conspiracy say you are crazy if you think there's conspiracy. Then there's the next level where they say, yes, there's a conspiracy, but you're crazy if you think conspiracy is bigger than what we say it is. Yeah. And so the hierarchy goes on.
That's right.
And it's important because we have to come together. And that whole thing about, he talks about reptilian entities, so he shouldn't come here and talk about the European Union, it means that it's just creating another fault line to divide and rule a united front against this tyranny as a whole. Because if people, Henrik, think that this global Orwellian state that's coming in so fast on so many multi-levels, in so many ways, in such detail, across different companies, countries, corporations, etc., if they think that's all being orchestrated by people in dark suits sitting around a table deciding their next move, well, they've lost the plot. It's much, much bigger than that. And we have to talk about it if we're going to understand, A, the true scale of what's going on, and big time important, where the key lies, where the master key lies to turn this around. Because it does. There is a master key. And we need to pursue things with an open mind if we're going to find that, which we will eventually. And not say, you mustn't go there because it's against my belief system, which is what the Irish Coalition was saying to me. This is ridiculous stuff.
It's just so sad. I mean, they should take issue by issue, and it doesn't matter what whatever you talk about. You came there to talk about the treaty and the nature of EU. I mean, that's the way they should deal with it. But anyway, what we can say, I guess, is that in whatever way we can, we try to relay the information to the Irish people and influence, in that sense, the Irish people and inform them about what's going on and what's happening. Because again, as you say, this can be stopped by them yet again, or at least postponed until they want to throw another one or whatever happens with that idea. But influence those we know and spread the information to the Irish people and try to do this before October, pretty much, when it's they're up for the second.
Yeah, I think it's October the 2nd, isn't it? October the 2nd, I think it is, when the vote, something like that.
Yeah. Okay, David, I know that you're tired and you're working so hard right now, and we got to leave you for this time. We had an hour, and we definitely want to have you back here on the show again in about a week or two, maybe, and talk about the swine flu issue, another one that's just insane, crazy. They talk about mandatory vaccinations and what have you. But in the meantime, I encourage everyone to go to davidicke.com, check out the website, sign up for David Icke's newsletter, of course. Mention some of your books and some of your DVDs that you have available for people, David, so they can support your work and keep you rolling and keep on going what you're doing.
Well, the last one was a compendium of my work so far, which pulls together enormous numbers of strands, dots, whatever you want to call them. It's called The David Icke Guide to the Global Conspiracy and How to End It. And there's another, there's a DVD, the latest DVD is also on the website as well, which people can see. That's 7 hours, which I connect dots with about 1,000 illustrations. The important thing is that people get involved and stop being spectators. That's going to change nothing. We need to get involved, and we don't have forever to do it now.
DavidIcke.com is the website. Thank you very much, David. Let's have you back there then in a couple of weeks or so.
Okay, Eric, no problem, mate.
Thank you very much for joining us, for keeping your eyes and ears open. Help to spread the word in any way you can, not only to the Irish, but to your friends and family. Let them know what's going on. And just as David said, together we can prevent this emerging global dictatorship. Okay, we'll have David back in about 2 weeks and talk more about the equally important swine flu issue and the forced vaccinations that many countries now seem to enforce. In the meantime, keep your eyes on our website, redicecreations.com. Architects of Control Program 1 is now available in our members section, and we have much more there for you to dive into. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth for their excellent work. We'll be back before you know it with more radio, webcasts, and film material. Freddy Silva and Freeman will join us next up on the program. Take good care, and also don't forget to have a good time on planet Earth. See you later.